Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, everybody. Catherine is back from Madrid. The tournament is done. Matt has just returned from the football. His voice might be a little bit gravelly because he's had five goals to celebrate today. Matt, is that accurate?
Yes, five goals and lots of singing, mocking John Terry. It was a pretty perfect 90 minutes.
Textbook day. Catherine and I, less enthusiastic about football.
Football's over, I think. It's had its day.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll move on then and talk about tennis. And given that this is the Tennis Podcast, that would seem fitting. This edition of the Tennis Podcast is brought to you in association with On Location, the premium hospitality and experience provider. On Location provides packages via Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours to all four of the Grand Slam tournaments, including the US Open, which is on sale now. And they have brilliant packages to the Laver Cup in Vancouver, which takes place 22nd to the 24th of September. And we can offer you, Tennis Podcast listeners, a 5% discount to Laver Cup weekend. Go to the URL toursfortennis.com/podcast. That's toursfortennis.com/podcast. Click the Laver Cup discount section and enter the code Vancouver, VANCOUVER. If you like got a dodgy spelling tendency like myself. So Vancouver is your code when you purchase an eligible 2023 Laver Cup travel package on onlocationexp.com between May the 4th, 2023 at 9 a.m. Eastern Time and May 31st, 2023 at 11:59 Eastern Time. The discount does not apply to Rocky Mountaineer train tour packages for the Laver Cup. I want to find out more about those, though. You can only use the code Vancouver once, and it cannot be used with other discounts or previous purchases. You'll see your savings when you add an eligible package to your cart and use the code at checkout. This offer does not apply to hotel packages or other events from Steve Fergal's International Tennis Tours or On Location and its subsidiaries. If you have any questions, email info@toursfortennis.com. See On Location EXP.com's purchase policy for more information. Catherine, how is Madrid, generally speaking?
That's a tough question now that I'm mentally on a Rocky Mountains train package in Canada.
We're Googling that after this.
I think I know it. I know what it is. It's on my bucket list. It's
okay.
Yeah, I mean, Vancouver is very much on my bucket list. I have to say that sounds. That sounds like a great trip. Yeah. What was happening last week? Madrid. I was there this morning. What was your question again, David?
Well, I asked how it was. And actually, let's just start with how the final of the women's singles was. And in fact, I mean, the finals generally were brilliant, weren't they? But let's start with the women's singles, which ended up with the match we all hoped we would get from day one when this draw was made, because I mean I know we talk about rivalries a lot, but it really does feel like we've got one now. Am I over egging it on the basis of two successive finals between the same two players and throwing Elena Rybakina and her achievements for the year for good measure? But these two at the moment, they feel like, I wouldn't say a sure thing every single tournament, but I always look at them as the players that are going to be the favourites to get to the finals. And I think I would say that on any surface right now. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think it is unquestionably a rivalry and a big deal rivalry in terms of storyline and narrative. It's dominating women's tennis at the moment, and rightly should. Whether it's a lasting rivalry, we don't know. Remains to be seen. I certainly hope so, but we know a lot can happen. But right at this moment, 100%, it is the rivalry that we've been wanting. And I slightly don't love the narrative about this gaping hole of desperation for a rivalry in women's tennis, and this is the answer to it, because, you know, Sabalenka and Rybakina have been rivalrying for the first part of this season, and Sabalenka and Barty had a rivalry there for a bit. It was all too fleeting. So we have had moments of really promising rivalry, like what we're in at the moment with Sabalenka and Świątek. We just haven't had that really lasting, baked in years long legacy building rivalry. This very well could be that, and we hope it will be that. But for the moment, I think we just need to appreciate it for what it is, which is a rivalry that I think has every ingredient that you want. A bit of spice. I don't think they're friends at all. I still don't know whether there's any specific reason for that. It might just be that they're both too competitive and intense to be friends with a close rival. There might be something more personal. I don't know. But it certainly feels edgy when they're on the court together. And it more than that, it feels unbelievably intense. You just feel like you're sucked into a vortex when they play, and you can't take your eyes off it. This was the one match this week that I put my phone down. There wasn't really a moment where I felt at risk of being distracted at all. I was just totally penis in a scribble, locked in for the whole thing. And P.S., the quality of the tennis was incredibly high as well. Those are the ingredients for me. Quality, you know, complementary game styles, and intensity. It's the intensity that I want to see.
Matter, I think we need to add penis and a scribble to tennis podcast terminology, the website page, just so that everybody knows what page we're on. But that's what Taylor Fritz drew when he wanted to explain that he's locked in. He thought he was drawing a padlock. He was actually not. He was drawing a penis in a scribble. So, this match itself, I mean, I think Catherine puts it very well about you don't end up reaching for a phone to fill in the blanks of the match and to kind of distract you when it's not very good, because it was always good. It was always intense. It was always exciting. It ended Sabalenka winning 6-3, 3-6, 6-3. What was your take on the match? Where was it won and lost? And were you surprised in the end that it went as it did once Świątek had levelled it at set all?
No, I don't think I was, actually, because I think a defining feature of Sabalenka this year has been that when matches start to go against her, she's able to stem the tide in a way that she never really used to be able to do. Sabalenka matches used to unravel, and they used to become a bit of a mess. And I didn't always enjoy watching them, to be quite honest. But I don't think there's a player I've enjoyed watching more than Sabalenka this year. And I think a lot of that is the intensity that Catherine's spoken about. And I just trust her now. I just know that even if she has a few games where things aren't quite working, she will get it back on track. And I think that is the difference, actually, between Sabalenka this year and in previous years. And I love watching it. And it was just such a gripping match. I think, you know, both singles finals were, and they were for different reasons, because the men's final surprised me in how competitive it was, whereas the women's final, I expected it to be great, and it really delivered on that hype. And I think that's always such a good feeling when you go in with high expectations and those are met. And it was a final where the momentum was just swinging back and forth all the time. I think it was 3-3 in the first set. And then from that point on, they each won 3 games in a row until the end of the match. You know, it went from 3-3 to 6-3, 3-love, 3-3, 6-3, 3-love, 3-3, 6-3. It was kind of a crazy match. You didn't really know who was going to win because the momentum was swinging back and forth. And it kept feeling like they were having to raise their level, each of them, to wrestle the momentum back. And the quality just got higher and higher. And I absolutely loved seeing Świątek in a match like that. It had been quite a while. I think I would probably go back to the Ostrava final of last year, where she was involved in a big match, and it was a 3-setter against Krejcikova, and this was similar. And I think Świątek comes out of it with quite a lot of positives, because there was a period in that match where I thought Sabalenka was almost unplayable in those conditions, hitting the ball that hard, that accurately. And then suddenly we were in a third set, and I was like, wow, how's this happened? Świątek's playing really, really well to make that happen. And for Sabalenka, I just think she was so clear in her game plan. The first set, I think she was hitting the ball 10 miles an hour harder on the backhand side than Iga Świątek. That was really noticeable as well. It felt like she went into that match with such purpose and such a point to prove. You know, we spoke about how she said she wanted to play Świątek, and she delivered on that. She went in with serious intent to win that and make it a rivalry. And she did it. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was brilliant.
Mm. You mentioned there that you feel as though Świątek still comes out of it with something positive. And I mean, to my mind, nothing changes in terms of her prospects on clay for the rest of the clay court season based on this final. This is a different tournament, different conditions, altitude, the ball's flying through the air in a way that I don't think it will in Rome or at Roland Garros. And I think they are more classic clay court circumstances, conditions, environments for Świątek to take advantage of. But my question to you both, to wrap this women's final up, is based on Sabalenka, what you've seen today, would you expect her to reach one or more of the next two tournaments' finals? You know, we're going to go on to the quintessential clay court conditions now, Rome and then Paris. And she's not always been that comfortable with the clay under her feet. She looked very different to me this week, but obviously she's won this tournament before 2 years ago. Catherine, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you think that this is going to carry on for her?
I think I haven't done my predictions yet. I think I probably will end up predicting Świątek and Sabalenka to meet in the final in Rome, because they both feel so reliable to me now, Sabalenka included. And while clay outside of Madrid isn't her favourite surface, I think she's just so good at tennis generally now that I do think she's the second best player in the world on clay right at this moment. But equally, it wouldn't surprise me if Sabalenka did lose sooner. Last year in Rome, she came up against Świątek, didn't she? I think around about the quarterfinal, and lost very, very heavily, which is one of the reasons I think that this victory was more important for Sabalenka than it would have been for Świątek. Objectively, I think Świątek was desperate for it. She was desperate to win that Madrid Open title. I could see that all week. There was, you know, we talked about it on Thursday, didn't we? There was, you know, a real no messing look in her eye. It was, I'm coming for you, Madrid. But I think, you know, Sabalenka's targeting the French Open. That's how she thinks now. She is thinking in terms of winning Grand Slam titles. And if they were to meet at Roland Garros, if she's to have a chance, I think mentally having a victory over Świątek recently and on clay is significant for her, even if on paper we'll obviously look at reasons why, you know, Madrid perhaps isn't as relevant for the Roland Garros form book. I think for her, it actually would be very relevant. I think I'll end up predicting it, but I also wouldn't be surprised at all if it doesn't happen, if that's not a completely contradictory answer.
She certainly doesn't limit herself, does she? She thinks that she should be able to do whatever she wants to do out there. That's how good she rates herself, and I kind of love that. What about you, Matt? Would you right now be putting her in at least one of the finals?
I think I probably will, yeah, because of exactly what Catherine said, just how good her level is. I just think it's very hard to ignore her. I don't think there's anyone else who I would be confident of beating Sabalenka on clay just because it's clay, maybe other than Iga Świątek. I think Sabalenka will be a match for anyone. I think it might come down to a bit of luck. You know, if there was a really cold, wet, damp day in Paris and windy and just really, really tough to get the ball through the court, I could see Sabalenka coming unstuck there if something like that happened. But if conditions are hot and bouncy and quick, like it can be sometimes, she could be really, really dangerous. So I think, you know, it feels like sort of small margins like that. I just looked up her record. She's never been beyond the third round at the French Open. And she's had the one semi-final in Rome last year against Świątek, where she beat Pegula and Anisimova along the way. So, you know, those are some good wins, but maybe they're not natural clay quarters either, I suppose. So difficult to say, but just with her form at the moment, it feels impossible to ignore her in that other half of the draw. And I agree. I think she's taking a lot of confidence from beating Świątek, and I think she's also coming for Iga Świątek's number one ranking. I think that's a big motivation for her. And you know, Świątek's had so many points to defend, and Sabalenka's just been racking them up. It could well change over at some point this year. And that might add to the rivalry element as well, that number one is kind of on the line between them as well. It's all great.
Tantalising, yeah. Very good. Well, listen, we've got a load to talk about in regard to the doubles finals, particularly on the women's side, and actually not even the on-the-court the stuff. You'll have no doubt heard everything that's been going on off the court. Before we get on to that, we'll just cover the men's singles final between Carlos Alcaraz and Jan-Lennard Struff, which is not a name I expected to be talking about in the final of the men's singles in Madrid. But
well, no, because he went out of the tournament 2 weeks ago.
I mean, that is, Catherine, I mean, I can't quite remember whether that is literally unprecedented at this level for a lucky loser, as they're called, when they're losing qualifying and they get lucky and get into the main draw because somebody else gets injured, then going all the way to a final of a Masters 1000. I can't remember whether I've heard that's happened or not.
No, it hasn't happened at Masters 1000, which goes back to 1990, I think, was when the series was launched. I mean, obviously, it's a bit like Premier League stats in that, you know, the difference between a Premier League stat and a top flight stat, that stat only dates back to the launch of what we now know as Masters 1000 events, and have been known as various different things over the years. But that's still 33 years, so it's still a good stat.
Yeah, it's a good stat, and it's a heck of an achievement for a player who I'd always, I suppose, regarded as one of the rank and file of the ATP Tour, a good top 50 player who comes along, beats some people when you're not really expecting it. You know, he's got this really straightforward power game. He's coming to get you. He's coming after you. And I always think he's the sort of player who beats Grigor Dimitrov or Denis Shapovalov or people with these flowery games who can do so much and we hype up such a lot, particularly me, and then along comes Jan Leonard Struff to just mess it all up for everybody.
He's the guy on MasterChef that comes along and just cooks the perfect steak and chips, and they're like, well, we can't not put in fruit. There's someone on the other side of the kitchen making his own pasta.
Brilliant. Yes, he is. And my word, did he make a steak and chips these last 2 weeks from having burnt it in qualifying. But I mean,
love that we're running with this.
he was amazing to watch. Just his tennis is extraordinary, Matt. I mean, what was he doing differently in this tournament, if anything, to your eye, that got him this result? What could you see anything different about Jan Leonard Struff apart from him just playing better than normally?
No, I mean, it seemed to me like he was playing his normal game. He was coming at opponents. He was coming forward. He was imposing himself. I think he hit his backhand way better than I've ever seen. I think that shot has improved. But actually, while I was sort of preparing for this podcast, I went back to have a listen to what we said about Jan Lennard Struff versus Carlos Alcaraz at Wimbledon last year, because that was a fantastic match. It was a five setter, and Struff really had Alcaraz on the ropes then as well. And basically what we said was Alcaraz just sort of has moments of greatness, and he can just suddenly just come up with something to separate himself from a player like Struff and get himself out of trouble. And I think that kind of was true again here, because Struff was absolutely a match for him in that final for the first two sets. I said I enjoyed seeing Iga Świątek in a real great battle, a three-set tussle, and I enjoyed seeing Carlos Alcaraz tested like this by a guy who was just refusing to let Alcaraz have his own way. I think I feared the worst when Struff double faulted twice in his opening service game and went one love down. And honestly, I was expecting a bit of a rout from that point on, and for Alcaraz to just, you know, win it pretty comfortably in straight sets. But Struff was really troubling and threatening the Alcaraz serve, something that we have spoken about a lot before, especially in Madrid, how Alcaraz's serve can kick up and cause all sorts of problems. And Struff, or what is he, 6'5" or something? He's a big man. He was getting on top of that ball and just pelting returns and making Alcaraz really uncomfortable and flustered. And Alcaraz was having to look over to his box a lot, and he changed his racket at one point. He was really uncomfortable on the court. And credit to Struff for making that happen. I think he ran out of steam a bit in that final set. There was some stat before the match that he'd pretty much spent double the amount of time on court that Alcaraz had had. I think he'd had four or five three-set matches in a row. And I think to play that attacking tennis, you need to be explosive. You need to have power in your legs. And I just think it went a little bit from him in that third set. And Alcaraz came up with some great shots and won it brilliantly. But it was a very enjoyable final. And credit to Struff for making it so, because there was a chance it was a blowout and he just wasn't going to let that happen. It was awesome.
He got pretty rattled at times in the match, I thought, Alcaraz. There wasn't the same conviction in every ground stroke, and I think a lot of it was due to his opponent just coming straight for him and not being prepared to get in the sort of rallies that Alcaraz wanted to get into. And that's been a feature of Struff all week long, and a bit Sabalenka-like, really, just knocking an opponent out of their comfort zone, what he did to Tsitsipas, and then he backed it up against Karatsev. I know Karatsev maybe wasn't 100% fit at the end in that semi-final, but even so, to do it to Alcaraz in front of Alcaraz's people on his court when the result has already been kind of written in the stars and scripted as being just an inevitability, and Struff just wasn't having any of that. He believes in himself and he went for it. But Catherine, in some ways, I regard that as maybe a bigger success for Alcaraz than if he'd just wiped the floor with him and played out of his mind, because he showed something else that he's got there in that final, didn't he?
Yeah, I would agree, and I'd apply that to his whole week, actually, in Madrid. There were three matches, really, where he had to win in the face of adversity, and they were all different types of adversity. He was, as we discussed in the previous podcast, bad against Emil Ruiz-Savory. You know, he pulled it together just in the nick of time, but for a set and a half, he was bad. And then there was his quarterfinal against Karen Khachanov, where he was brilliant for the first set, seemed to be in control, and then the conditions changed completely. It started getting, as it can in Madrid, the wind can just appear out of nowhere, and he suddenly started to really struggle, and suddenly Khachanov, with his big meat and potatoes game, is in control of things, and Alcaraz started to look stressed and had to find new ways to win points in the different conditions. And then you had this in the final against Struff, where Struff is seemingly, for a while there, seems to have figured out the Alcaraz cheat codes. I mean, you still have to have the ability to execute those cheat codes. And as you said, Matt, being 6'5", maybe more, certainly helps. You know, it's a way to neutralise that kick serve, but you still have to have the guts to take a really aggressive return position against Alcaraz. He was standing, you know, inside the court a lot of the time to receive that serve, to hit it sort of on the rise before it had a chance to really rear up on him. So, yeah, there was a lot of not quite winning ugly, but not winning Alcaraz-y in Madrid. It certainly was a very different run to the title to what we saw last year, which was just jaw on the floor, beating Nadal and Djokovic back to back in just the most high quality matches imaginable, and wiping the floor with Zverev in the final. I mean, he still wiped the floor with Zverev this year. That was probably the only similarity. But, you know, he did it in sublime form last year and then had a disappointing French Open. I think it can... I think this is good. I think this is good for Carlos Alcaraz. I'm fascinated by what happens in Rome, how hungry he is for Rome. I definitely think he's motivated to play there. He has never played in Rome before, which is one of those just little reminders of how young and inexperienced he still is. I think he's very motivated to play there, not just because he knows, he loves the sport, he understands the sport, and he knows that Rome is part of the fabric of the sport's history. And he's just like, he's still like a big kid, isn't he? He's excited to play it for the first time. He also will reclaim his number one ranking by playing in Rome, by virtue of the fact that he didn't play there last year. All he has to do is play one match. He becomes world number one again. That would mean he is the top seed at Roland Garros. I think those are all motivators. How hungry he is to go all the way and play all of that tennis, I don't know. But then
I don't think he knows any other way. I think he's like Nadal like that. I think maybe Ferrero might look at it and think, I'm not sure this is
You the say that, but Nadal had pragmatic moments in his career, hasn't he? Where, you know, he's in the back of his mind, he's thought, yeah, okay, I've got the matches I need now.
I've had
the edge.
Now.
He's not tanking, but the edge goes.
Yeah, no, I take that point, but I don't think at 19, 20 he would have done. And I just think, look, I think if Alcaraz gets injured or a twinge, we might see some common sense, I suppose, in that situation. But I just think I think that excitement that you talk about of getting to play Rome for the first time is going to be pretty intoxicating for him. What I would say about him, I mean, two things that struck me. One about the final was something came to my mind from I've been watching our favourite golf podcasters, No Laying Up, doing a video from a few years ago where they told about the guy Neil, who's on there, told about how he'd once heard a golfer say that before he hits a shot, he tries to make himself smile before he hits it to get himself in a really good frame of mind. And there was a moment where Alcaraz was really trying desperately to get a break of serve. He'd got four break points in a 15-minute game, I think, in the second set, and he couldn't sort of take it. And then he just broke into this massive smile. And you're thinking, this is the most stressful moment. Here you are, smiling at Juan Carlos Ferrer as they're having the best time. And can you see what's going on here? This is amazing. And how on earth is he saving all these break points? But I just thought, actually, that's a very good stress...
way of
getting rid of stress in the moment, and I loved it.
They do say it releases endorphins, don't they? Just the act of smiling.
Mm. And it must be soul destroying for the person down the other end of the court who's like, haven't I broken you yet? Why are you still so pleased with yourself?
the other thing is, I am still fascinated to see how he gets on in Rome and in Paris generally, because I still don't think we have seen Carlos Alcaraz, the clay court player, yet. I know he's done it in South America and he's done it in Madrid, but they're different. And here he is now. He had a decent run at Roland Garros, but he very nearly lost to Albert Ramos Vinolas, very nearly. And he also ended up losing to Zverev, who he'd beaten comfortably in Madrid. So this is a proper clay court tournament coming up now in Rome. And I know that might sound like a diss of Madrid. It's not meant to be, but that's kind of how I feel about it in terms of what a real clay court tournament traditionally is. And I'm fascinated to see whether his game translates as spectacularly as it does everywhere else. So it's going to be a really cool experiment in many ways.
And he's in a draw with Novak Djokovic. Praise be.
Yeah.
That's bloody time.
It's only the third time it's happened since Wimbledon last year. And it's the first time it's happened all year. And yeah, it's very exciting to see those two names in a draw. And I just think what I would say about what Alcaraz has done over the last couple of weeks by defending his titles in Barcelona and in Madrid, to me, he's doing the thing that great players do, in that he's building an aura in certain tournaments. And, you know, the tennis tour goes to the same places every year. So if you can have places where you constantly play well, that is great. That means you're going to have times in the year where you're feeling great and where you're going to pick up points. And, you know, just looking at the big three, they've always had that. You know, they've always just had tournaments where you know they're going to play well. And Serena always had it, like in Miami, for example. Like, I just think you can build up a bit of a dynasty in these certain places. And it kind of feels like he's already doing that, which is crazy to me. But, you know, I know we joke about Medvedev and how he's won, 19 titles in 19 different places. That is very admirable in lots of ways. It sort of shows an ability to adapt, but I don't know whether it's great for domination to have that kind of record, whereas what Alcaraz is doing is showing that I think he's kind of capable of dominating. But as you said, we've got those events out of the way now, and now we're on to sort of new territory for him to try and conquer, I suppose. So that's a really interesting dynamic, I think, to Alcaraz's season.
Yeah. Djokovic has got a half of the draw in Rome, by the way, with Holger Rune potentially as a quarterfinal opponent, and Jannik Sinner maybe in the semi-finals before he gets to Alcaraz, assuming Alcaraz gets that far. So we are in for a cracking week. No word on who Leonard Struff has got in Rome. We haven't looked that up. But I do think he's going to have a very interesting player to watch on grass this year. I mean, I kind of feel like he probably always should have been. But, you know, I'd love to see him and Marvin, his pal in the corner, come over to Wimbledon and start screaming the odds and knocking on the doors.
Well, I mean, watch out, Rome. Marvin is coming.
Well, you say that.
Is he not in the draw?
I don't think he's in the draw. I mean, he got a wild card into... Did he get a wild card into qualies? No, he didn't get a wild card into Madrid, where maybe he should have done. He had to qualify.
Yes.
I don't think his ranking is...
Because, of course...
Because entry lists are done in advance.
He's now at a career high ranking, 28 in the world, which is incredible. Mm. That'll get him... Should just about get him seeded for Roland Garros, regardless of what happens in Rome. But wow, yeah, it is possible, because his ranking, this isn't totally out of nowhere for Struff. He's been on a, obviously the extent of it is, but he's been on a steady rise all year. So that does make sense, actually, that his ranking might not have been high enough to get him into the main draw at the time of the entry list. And obviously he's missed the boat on qualifying by accidentally reaching the final in Madrid. So all of that lovely Marvin bonus check, no check from Rome this week for Marvin. Maybe they'll just have week-long celebrations, although I think Marvin needs to go on a silent retreat or something.
Chill out for a bit.
To renew his energy supplies. Not even the greatest hype man in the world, which he actually might be. I mean, surely they have to rest, even them.
Have a lie down, Marvin. Yeah, we do have to rest occasionally.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Right then, that's the singles. What about the doubles? I mean, first of all, I can tell you that Andrei Rublev and Karen Khachanov won the doubles final 10-3 in a match tiebreak against Rohan Bopanna and Matthew Ebden, and they subsequently gave lovely speeches on the court to explain how happy they are at having won those titles and participated in the final. That was followed the following day on Sunday with a doubles final between Victoria Azarenka and Beatriz Haddad-Maia, a scratch pair up against much more familiar partners Jessica Pegula and Coco Gauff, and Azarenka and Haddad-Maia won 6-1, 6-4 to win that title. So that was a heck of an achievement, Catherine, in its own right.
Yeah, just on that performance, I think Azarenka in that doubles final might have been the performance of the week in terms of tennis.
Really?
I mean, it was, she could not miss. It was astonishing. Wow. It's quite rare for a doubles match to be really one-sided, let alone in a final like that against Gauff and Pegula, who'd been playing great all week. And they just weren't in the match, because Azarenka just walked on court and just seized it. She said, "Yeah, I'm here now. This is all." Haddad-Maia was good, but I didn't really notice how good, because Azarenka was just right in the zone. It was astonishing. And then Goff and Pegula had a bit of a rally at the start of the second set. And then Azarenka just went, oh, no, not having this. And then started being brilliant again. It was the performance of the week, I think. It was breathtaking, seriously. Yeah. Potentially the performance of a woman with a point to prove, potentially.
Mm. So they've won the title. Catherine, you're courtside at this point, presenting live TV coverage for Prime in the UK. What happened next?
So what we do is we usually come in, myself and the pundits, Daniela Hunter-Kovic, Gregor Rozenski, we start talking over the picture, because I don't know whether we mentioned this before, there's quite a lot of faff in tennis. And so there's a sort of 10-minute period where after the last point is played in a final where a stage gets constructed. And, you know, ball kids and photographers and lines people and umpires and all the rest of it, court furniture gets put in position, interviews get conducted, players go and celebrate with their team a little bit. There's a period of faff during which we're just talking over the pictures and saying, isn't this lovely? Bracing ourselves for the confetti cannon to go off. And then once the presentation ceremony starts, I then kind of throw to that and say, we'll now get the chance to hear from both sets of finalists. And our arrangement with both tours is that the winners also, once they've received their trophies, they then meander over and do a live interview with us on Prime in our presentation position in the corner of the court, which is amazing. It's a brilliant position. It looks really cool. We've had some great interviews all week, and one of the best actually was with Hashinov and Rublev the day before. It was a real good vibe zone when they came over after winning the men's doubles title. So I threw to the presentation ceremony just as Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula were being announced onto the stage, and I said, we'll have Azarenka and Haddad Maia come and talk to us here, but we'll also now get the chance to hear from Coco Gauff and Jessica Pegula. And we didn't. They walked up to the stage where Feliciano Lopez and various other tournament officials are there. They receive their trophies, their runners-up trophies, and then they're told that they look confused. They're obviously waiting to be handed the microphones, as is normal, customary, as was on the script, and they're not. What happens then is Victoria Azarenka and Beatrice Haddad Maia called up to receive their winners' trophies. They too then look confused, aren't given any microphones. They are ushered, the four of them, onto the stage, the podium together, to have very brief photos taken, all four of them, during which time there's quite a lot of chit-chat between them. And then they're ushered off court. And that's that. And they don't come over to us for an interview, Azarenka and Haddad Maia. They look in a desperate hurry to get off court. And none of us had any idea what was going on.
So just to be clear, we didn't know whether this was the players not wanting to speak or something else was pressing, but I mean, this is several hours before the men's singles final's about to take place. There was plenty of time. It's not like the tournament was rushed or anything like that. So the players depart the court, and within a few minutes, and there's a lot of chatter as to where are the women and why are they not giving speeches. And shortly after this final takes place, Coco Gauff tweets, "Wasn't given the chance to speak after the final today. But thank you to the fans for supporting us in women's tennis this week. Thanks to Jessica Pegula for always keeping it fun on the court and hitting unreal clutch shots. Lastly, big congratulations, Vika and Bia. Also, thanks to my team and Jess's team, of course. Also, for the Ball Kids tournament staff and everyone else who works hard behind the scenes. Twitter format doesn't allow me to say everything I would have said during the speech if we had one, but just wanted to say I'm thankful." Victoria Azarenka then tweeted, "Hard to explain to Leo," Leo's her young son, that Mommy isn't able to say hello to him at the trophy ceremony. That was then retweeted, or rather the Coco Gauff tweet was retweeted by Ons Jabeur, who said, "So unfortunate that you were not given a chance to address the crowd and your opponents. This is sad and unacceptable." So from what we're hearing, Catherine, this is not the players deciding they don't want to talk. This is them not being given the chance to talk by the tournament in the same way the men were after the final.
Correct.
What's going on?
Correct. And the tournament, despite requests from every angle to give an explanation for what happened, the tournament have not given any such explanation, either on the record or off the record. Nothing. They've remained completely silent on it, which leaves us only to speculate. I find that incredibly disappointing from them. You know, they've been given the opportunity to try and explain what looks like an appalling and completely misjudged decision, and they're not even respecting the situation enough to try and explain it. They're just hoping it goes away, which is feeble, I think. Look, the background to this story is, I can't believe I'm going to say this, Cake Gate.
Yeah. What's Cake Gate?
Oh, Matt, do you want to do Cake Gate?
Sure. I mean, I feel like Cake Gate is going to come up in Madrid every year because Carlos Alcaraz and Aryna Sabalenka celebrate their birthdays during Madrid. They're both the 5th of May. And actually, we had it a couple of years ago where Sabalenka didn't get a cake and Alcaraz did. And look, it's cake. I think everyone at the time sort of thought, oh, that's a bit weird, but maybe didn't think too much of it also. This year, Alcaraz gets an enormous cake. I mean, absolutely enormous. Several tiers, encore, ceremony. He bites into it. It's a whole thing. You know, it's all front and centre. Look at Carlos Alcaraz's cake. Sabalenka, who I don't think was playing that day, got some kind of cake behind the scenes, and it was much smaller. And a Twitter user, Slayla Fritz, great name, put on Twitter a side-by-side and saying the difference in cake size is astounding. And it was a picture of Alcaraz with his huge cake and Sabalenka with her smaller cake. And that was, quote, retweeted by Victoria Azarenka saying, couldn't be more accurate on the treatment. So that's a pretty serious tweet, actually, from Azarenka there. And I think, reading between the lines, the idea is it's not about the cake, it's about what the cake represents, which, saying it out loud, sounds sounds stupid. But I think the feeling is that the women feel that they are treated as second rate in Madrid. Examples such as getting a smaller cake and, you know, some scheduling issues. Remember last year, the women's final was between the men's singles semi-finals. You know, it felt very much like it was second rate, second class. And I think this has probably been building for a few years, this general feeling that the women are not getting the same treatment as the men by the tournament. And as Catherine said, with no explanation at all from the tournament, we are left to, you know, speculate and assume what the reason is for why they weren't allowed to speak. And it feels like too big of a coincidence that Azarenka was the one who sent that tweet and then is the one who's not allowed to speak in the doubles final. It feels like those two events are connected. And of course, it's an awful move by the tournament because all they are doing is reinforcing Azarenka's point by, you know, sort of gagging her and not allowing her to have her say. So deeply, deeply troubling, I think.
There was also, in terms of sort of adding to that tapestry of potential explanation, in the women's singles final the day before, Iga Swiatek in her speech had had a pop at being scheduled to play one of her matches at 1 o'clock in the morning, as is not hugely uncommon in Madrid. She, you know, perhaps wasn't the best moment for her to say that in terms of, you know, sore loserdom. It was a salty comment at the time, but, you know, she absolutely has a point that on scheduling. I don't think tennis players should be having to play tennis at 1 o'clock in the morning. And obviously that doesn't only happen to women. It happens a lot to everybody in Madrid, but in this case, it happened to Iga Świątek, and she wanted to make the point that she feels that it impacted her chances in the final. So you had this image from the day before of Feliciano Lopez there and the rest of the tournament officials looking pretty sour-faced while Świątek is there with the microphone in her hand, using that moment to express her displeasure at some of the treatment from the tournament. And look, it's not about the cake. This tournament has work to do to prove that it values women. So much work to do. The men's singles final featured models as ball girls. I don't know why they were wearing basketball shorts for that match. If that was an attempt to respond to some of the criticism about having model ball girls and having them wearing what they've been wearing all week, it was a feeble response, an utterly feeble and pretty irrelevant response. This tournament, I know it is under different ownership now. It's now owned by IMG, and this was something that happened under the previous ownership of Jon Tyriac. But as recently as 2018, the then tournament director Jon Tyriac tried to sue the WTA in order to not pay equal prize money. He was unsuccessful, and he's no longer involved in the tournament. But that is recent history. That is in the DNA of the tournament. You know, the scheduling of the women's final last year, that was 12 months ago. You know, the cake does tell a story. This tournament needs to be proving to female players that it values women. And gagging them is appalling. Is absolutely appalling. And for anybody thinking, oh, what does it matter? All they would do is, you know, thank the ball kids and the officials, thank their teams and say, you know, well done to the other team. They played really well. Well, first of all, I just think it's an important pillar of tennis. Sometimes TV people behind the scenes get quite frustrated about the fact that, you know, double ceremonies can go on for a long time because both members of the team are allowed to speak and there's not really any time limits on how long they speak for. And I do understand that sometimes when you're on a schedule for TV, it can be frustrating. But I really think it's an important staple. It's an important principle that all four of them should get to speak. That's something you earn,
especially if the men are doing exactly the same.
But just as a matter of principle generally, I think it's important. And I also think it sort of justifies, it's so brutal that the people that lose the final have to stay on court for the ceremony of the person that beat them, the team that beat them. It's a slight, you know, sort of mitigation for that, isn't it? That you get to speak and thank your team. It's also important for sponsors. You know, all of those four players would have had sponsors to whom, you know, them being able to stand there and give a speech and thank their sponsors and thank the tournament sponsors. All of that stuff matters. It's a tradition in tennis for a reason. And it was just an appalling move. And I hope desperately that they regret it. And it was just an in the moment miscalculation. But come out and say that. Come out and say that, and you know, and state some intent to rectify this for the future, an acknowledgement of the tournament's history, and that this feeling among WTA players exists.
Mm. I have contacted the WTA and asked for comments. I've yet to receive a response on that. I have also messaged Feliciano Lopez, who's somebody I knew from the years in which he was competing at the sharp end of the Queen's tournament. I haven't had a response from him at this point. I mean, that was only earlier today. I accept that this is the day after the tournament is concluded and they're very heavy weeks, but I haven't had a response yet. And I should also add that he is the figurehead of a big operation there, and exactly where his role begins and ends is difficult for us from the outside to decipher, as to whether he is involved in scheduling, whether he's involved in or heavily involved in a decision like whether the players have a say on following a ceremony or not. But he certainly knows what the protocol is because he's won enough trophies and very much enjoyed taking the mic whenever he has. So, I do think an explanation is required, and required as quickly as possible. As soon as we hear one, we'll bring it to you. Away from Rome, Andy Murray has got a win at a tennis tournament. It was at challenger level, at that extraordinary level challenger tournament in Aix-en-Provence in France, and he beat Tommy Paul in three sets. I watched it whilst walking around Cheltenham on a day off with the family. I just sort of switched on for the final set and to see the final scenes. And it, I mean, they do run the most fantastic tournaments in France at pretty much every level, and this was ram-packed with people, really close into the court with the galleries of fans, and Murray's there with his mum, and I think Matt Little might have been there and his agent, and they're all close to the court, and you can see how much it meant to Andy Murray. I gotta be honest, I really wasn't expecting him to win that tournament given what we'd seen on him from clay so far this season. I even thought he might pull the cord on the clay court season and not bother with Rome and Paris the way things were going. This feels like a, you know, I don't know whether it'll mean anything, but I tell you what it does mean. It means he can still bloody well play tennis to a high level.
And it means ranking points. He's back inside the world's top 50, isn't it? And I increasingly think this is all about getting seeded for Wimbledon. That's what I think this clay court season is about, and why he's remaining committed to it. And also, yeah, get, you know, getting wins and trying to get some form together.
Yeah,
but
that's big, I think, really, because it must be really disconcerting to be a player of his history losing badly to players that he in the past would have beaten fairly efficiently. So anyway, great win for him. Few other small lines from over the course of the week. Well, they're not small lines. Did we say that Rafael Nadal was out of Rome? Well, he is. He's not playing Rome. And that means that if he's going to play Roland Garros, he's either got to have 1 week of a tournament in the week before, or he's going to come in literally cold into, not literally cold.
Well,
he's going to come in cold.
The weather can be unpredictable in Paris in May, David.
He's going to come in literally without any matches.
Do you think Geneva are preparing their Nadal red carpet, rubbing their hands together? I don't think he'll play before. I don't think he'll play that
week. Is he going to play Roland Garros? I think if I had
to guess now, I'd say no. I don't think he plays if he doesn't think he can win. And I don't see how, at this age and physicality, he can win having not played for, what'll it be, 18 weeks? Something like that.
Yeah, I mean, this announcement came with a slight positive. He did mention and point to some improvement that he'd seen in the last few days since his previous update about trying a new treatment. It was a bit kind of triggering, this one, because they didn't bother to record a new video announcing it. They just put out a statement, but they included the same still from the previous video along with the message. So I was like, oh God, it's this again. You know, it was sort of preparing you for the worst. And obviously it is bad news that he's out of Rome, but there is, I suppose, a slight bit of, you know, something to hang a bit of hope on in this message, whereas there kind of wasn't in the other one. But yeah, I mean, he's only won five matches since Wimbledon last year, Rafael Nadal, and we're talking about him trying to win seven in 2 weeks, you know, and it's a completely unprecedented situation because, as Catherine said, I don't think Nadal's going to Roland Garros just to be at Roland Garros. And, you know, I'm not sure I want that. Look, I don't want Roland Garros without Rafael Nadal, of course, but I don't want to see an injured, there for the taking, Rafael Nadal at Roland Garros either. I think that will feel very uncomfortable, and he will feel uncomfortable like that. So it just feels like such a long way still for him to go with so little time.
Yeah, it does. Fingers crossed that something can happen that will make it possible for him to play and be competitive. But yeah, that does feel pretty unlikely just at the moment. One final note for this week's show. You may have seen a story about the Russian player Veronika Kudermetova, who had a decent run at the tournament, being sponsored by one of the country's oil and gas giants, Tatneft. She's been wearing a logo on her kit throughout the tournament. And there was some discussion as to, you know, is that allowed? Especially given the announcements by Wimbledon recently that they're going to require players to sign a declaration not to have financial support from Russian companies and to wear patches of that ilk. And so she was asked about it. She says, I'm allowed to do it during this tournament and on the tour generally, and I'm just not allowed to do it at Wimbledon, so I'm going to take it off there. So we decided to check with Wimbledon and with the Lawn Tennis Association, who are involved in all the British tournaments that are put on and require this declaration to be signed by the Russian players and the Belarusian players ahead of competing if they want to compete at those tournaments. And basically the gist of it is the registration form that Russian and Belarusian players have got to sign to compete states that while they're participating in the championships at Wimbledon, and the same will apply at the other British tournaments at the time in the lead-up, the player will not be in receipt of funding from Russian or Belarusian states, including sponsorship from companies operated or controlled by the Russian and or Belarusian states. So that means they can't wear these logos and they can't receive money. The question I would love to know is, well, yes, they might not be able to earn any money from your tournament for those 2 weeks, but what if they did a deal with that company that compensates them and doubles their money before the tournament or after the tournament? And the gist is, I mean, basically, they just don't have the jurisdiction on anything outside of those 2 weeks. So it does feel like there's a bit of a loophole there. I mean, I suppose you might say, well, there's no visibility for those companies during Wimbledon as long as they're signing this thing and not wearing a patch and talking about those companies. But actual funding, I don't see how you can stop them getting the same amount just at different times of the year. I mean, and that's basically the fact. But that's one story that was bubbling up over the last week, and we'll see how it develops. Now, for us, we'll be back with you in a week's time for the next regular edition of the Tennis Podcast to update you with Rome. Catherine is going to be going out there about a week today, aren't you, Catherine, to cover the tournament for Prime, courtside once again. So we'll have three shows for you over the course of the second week of Rome. Our next one will be next Monday. But before then, we're going to have a Tennis Relived for you. The Nick Bollettieri story is going to be recording this week, and we'll have it for Friends of the Tennis Podcast. So if you'd like to become a friend, you can get immediate access to, I think, about 8 shows that we've already recorded this year, Q&As with the three of us and friends of the show, as well as several other Tennis Relived editions. We had The Movement, the story of the post-Agassi Sampras era from a couple of weeks ago. We had the Monica Seles story. Matt, Catherine and I are working on several more for the rest of the year as well. And becoming a friend of the Tennis Podcast really is your way of supporting everything we do and enabling it to happen. Yeah, you get loads and loads of extra podcasts as part of it. And you can become a friend from £50 a year or £5 a month. You can also get a shout out. You can get an intro to the show. So do become a friend of the Tennis Podcast. The link to do so is in the show notes to this one. we have an episode mascot. In fact, we have two. Alfie and Hunter, owned by Jonathan. Alfie is 8, Hunter is 6. They are both, they are brother and sister miniature schnauzers. Is that right, Catherine?
Schnauzers, yeah.
Okay, excellent. Mm. Alfie's big sister, and definitely the boss of the house, who's happiest chilling out on the couch, getting belly rubs. Hunter is the troublemaker of the pair and has endless amounts of energy. If it was up to him, he'd just play all day. And they do look very happy.
They do, and well groomed as well. I'll tell you what, those in this photo at least, and who knows how representative this is of general life, those are recently bathed and groomed dogs, and they are beautiful. I noticed that the mallard toy in the background is one that I recognise very well. That's one of Rosie's favourites. It makes a sort of noise.
I see. So there we are. Alfie, Hunter, lovely to have you as mascots of the Tennis Podcast. We've got our own personal mascots as well for the year. Mine is Maisie. Catherine's is Xenia. Matt's is Darwin. Billie Jean has her own sponsors. They are Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. And shout-outs are back.
They are, yes. We've got some very good shout-outs today, starting with Anna Keating in Gloucestershire.
Right, Anna.
We know Anna, don't we? Anna's had a shout-out before, and I think I gave her Ronan Keating, so I need to not give her Ronan Keating again.
She does specifically say, no relation.
like Anna Ivanovich.
Anna Ivanovich. Oh, that's one N, isn't it?
Anna Kournikova.
There we go. Well done, Matt.
Okay. You can tell I've been doing voluntary
Anna
research.
Anna Chakvitadze.
Oh, Catherine, yes. That's very nailed impressive. It. Cheers, Anna. Thanks very much for being a friend.
We've also got Roz van der Zwet in Wollongong in Australia.
Hello, oh, Roz.
Word, what a name.
That Roz is my mum's name, or the shortened version of my mum's name. So, great name.
And Roz says, I miss Ash Barty on the tour, and I have a request for Catherine. In her excellent Aussie accent, could I get an Ash Barty for old time's sake, please?
Ash Barty? Barty party? Oh, I miss that.
I miss her now.
Thank you, Roz. Great name.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And finally, but by no means least, we have Barbara Law in Solihull.
Oh.
Hey, my mum.
Barbara says, I'm the proud mum of David on the podcast team. I listen to all the podcasts. I'd be in trouble if I didn't. I love them.
Well, this can be like Carlos Alcaraz's Madrid title, which he wrote on the camera was for his mum. This podcast is for your mum, David.
Hey. Oh, how lovely. Oh, thank you very much, Mum. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to our lovely mascots, Alfie and Hunter, and everybody for listening to this show. We'll be back with you in another week's time. Don't forget that Friends of the Pod show about Nick Bollettieri. That's coming your way in the next few days. But for now, from us, we'll see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.